Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Yeah, hooray. So guys, we're back once again to talk about a film, and we're gonna talk about it, so let's talk about it now. Talk. That film is Amos and Andrew. Yeah, I'm rolling with that intro, whatever. The film is Amos and Andrew. It's from 1994.
Three.
I picked it. And before we get into why I picked it and what your expectations were and what your expectations were going in, can someone read us out some of the prescient details of who made it and is in it?
This week we're watching Amos and Andrew from 1993, directed and written by E. Max Fry. Starring Nicolas Cage, Samuel Jackson, and Dabney Coleman.
I think it's important to point out here at the start, the film stars Nicolas Cage and not Nick Cage. It's one of those films.
Ooh, what's that, does that mean that's Art House Cage, or is it...
It means it's Actor Cage. Like, Nicolas Cage is in Wild at Heart and Vampire's Kiss and Amos and Andrew... Leaving Las Vegas, you know, that kind of stuff. Nick Cage is in Gone in 60 Seconds and Bangkok Dangerous and Con Air and all that kind of stuff. There's two different Cages.
I suppose there's also Nicholas Coppola, who is extra and son of famous directory man.
And that, yeah, he just had crazy bushy eyebrows. Everyone forgot about him pretty fast.
Yeah. My favourite Nicolas Cage movie is, of course, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, where he has a tiny, tiny cameo as like a fry cook and is maybe is in the background of another scene. And no, that is my favourite, but it is a tremendously weird film that has Nick Cage in, but barely at all. I just thought I'd bring it up because it's one of those weird Nick Cage movies that isn't really. So I think there's a third Cage, and that's Extra. I didn't realise that he changes his name up. Or is that a hard and fast
rule? No, that's me. That's me being able to differentiate.
Oh, okay, so
that's my own rule.
It's kind of people arbitrarily call him Nick or Nicholas.
Yeah, no one, like that's my way of categorising which movies are worth watching and which ones aren't.
So you're a bit of a Nick Cage fan then, JB? I'm interpreting.
Nicolas Cage. I like him when, like, he's in either serious or weird stuff. You know, like Raising Arizona or Vampire's Kiss or Wild at Heart. You know, any of those ones that I named. When he's, like, straight action hero, he's just a bit rubbish. Or you get, like, weird in-between roles, like National Treasure, where, yeah, for the most part, he plays it straight. And then every now and again, he goes a little bit mental and then goes back to being a straight man again.
Yeah, I like it when, I'll just call him Cage for sake of confusing the two separate actors. I like it when Cage is let off the leash a bit. And like, in a straight role, it's funny when you see the crazier side of his approach to acting. But I do like a uncaged Cage, if you will.
Yeah,
you know?
He's like a more dangerous and maybe homeless Jim Carrey.
Okay. But he's not the only reason I decided we should watch this film. It's also because I wanted to watch a Samuel Jackson film. I think he's another tremendous actor. And in many ways, there's many kinds of L. Jacksons. And I think he's in so many films. Like in the 90s, he's got many a cameo role in things. And then when he became super famous off the back of stuff like Pulp Fiction, I mean, he's turning up with his own movies. And, you know, he's in loads of stuff. And considering his career started so late, it's kind of an amazing just achievement that he's one of the best paid actors in the world, you know?
I feel like he's lost his singular soft edge at roughly the same time he lost his hair.
His singular soft edge? At what?
Like... He always plays someone who's kind of intense, but up to a certain point, they were also quite... They had this nice human side to them, and this sort of softer bit to them that made it nice and rounded.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff lately has just been a bit more,
You're making him sound like fruit.
I think I get what you're saying. You're saying you prefer films where they didn't just get Sam Jackson in because he's a badass mofo. They got him in because they just liked him and wanted him to do something interesting. And again, like Cage, I think he's best at his craziest. In this, he's a semi-straight man. But when he's asked to be completely, like... When he's like an insane hobo in The Hunt for... no, what's it called? Search for One-Eyed Jimmy.
Search for One-Eyed Jimmy.
Which was another interesting film that's a bit obscure. But he's good as a maniac. I like a crazy Jackson. But they're both in this. And I was like, two birds, one stone, let's do it. And I just happened to have seen this film before. And I thought I'd put it to you guys. So what were you guys expecting coming into this film?
Well, I'd seen this film before as part of Nick Cage season.
You say season? You mean when we decided we'd watch a bunch of Nick Cage films?
Yeah, not a national holiday.
Yeah. Although, if there is to be one, I'd happily endorse Nick Cage season.
Yeah.
Or Nicolas Cage, if you prefer.
But at the time, I thought it was going to be a not more serious exactly, but not quite so slapstick.
Well, it is kind of a farce. I mean, farces are rare as Hollywood movies and stuff. But I would say it is a comedy. It's slightly a thrill, but it is definitely a farce. That's what I think, anyway.
And it's just something I've never really had Nick Cage and Samuel Jackson down for. Is farce.
I guess.
Nicolas Cage, really?
Not. Yeah, but he's not, like, I don't know, if anything, he's a fairly, like, reasonable character in this. I mean, he's a bit goofy, but anyway. Like, Nick Cage is farcical in things, but you just don't get that many comedies of this nature, really, from Americans.
That's what I was going to say, that Nick Cage, he will be the crazy thing in something, but generally speaking, the rest of the movie is... has to be quite calm in order to contain him.
I thought he was surprisingly subdued, considering who he, like, played. And after I watched the trailer, I thought, oh, this is going to be Crazy Cage, but not really.
No.
I guess.
Like, a little bit, like, enough, but not, like, way over the top.
So you maybe had high expectations for wacky craziness coming into it?
Yeah, I'd never heard of it before. I was confused because I thought it was like some kind of weird 90s movie version of Amos and Andy.
Yes.
And I was like, is this going to be some bizarrely offensive blackface wacky 90s movie? But I watched the trailer and I don't know. I think on the back of the trailer, I was expecting it to be quite like, I hate the word wacky, but I keep saying it. But, like, that kind of, you know...
Zany.
Like, silly.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, it had that trailer voice, you know, two men, and I was like, oh, man, I know where this is going. But I wasn't expecting maybe to be as endeared to some of the characters as I actually was.
Okay.
Like, I think it grabbed me a little bit more than I was expecting.
To me, it has, like... only a little bit, shades of like Fargo about it as well. Like, it's not quite that good in that that style, but it's got a little small town feeling.
It does have that. It has that. It has that caper, that old-fashioned caper thing that like almost all of the Coen Brothers movies have.
Yeah.
Without
quite the professional sheen that they.
That's not. Compared to a Coen Brothers movie, but like it's that kind of like silly escalation of just a ridiculous situation.
Yeah. Well, to clear up the thing about the reference to, I guess, a radio show that became a sitcom, I think Amos and Andy, like you said, was a radio show that was written by white guys and they played black characters and it was a bit like, oh, this is weird. But it was the 30s and that's just a part of the history. It's not that weird in context, and apparently it was one of the less like stereotype filled shows. It was just a traditional sitcom, and it just so happened that white guys were voicing black guys. And then in the 1950s, I think it became a TV show actually starring black actors, and again a fairly traditional type sitcom, not really that controversial. I mean, it might have got some controversy, but I don't know much about it other than
I think it's one of those things that's controversial looking back. Like, it's one of those things that people look back on and just go, oh, wow. You know, like, oh, really? but in the context of its time, it serves as a way to, you know, act as an example of changing attitudes towards certain things.
Yeah, so I think the film really relates to it in that it was a reference to that TV show and radio show, and they kind of, I think they make I think Samuel Jackson's character of Andrew makes reference to who the famous Amos and Andy are, but they don't want to get into it because, like, it's kind of just a throwaway line in it.
Yeah, because he calls them Amos and Andy, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because when he says they're gangsters, and he says, don't say our names together like that.
Yeah. So, I don't know much about the context, but I did look it up, but it seems that it's not that related to...
I think it's... My assumption is that it's to do with attitudes towards race and race relations, because, you know, that's a huge part of what the film kind of becomes.
Yeah.
Is, like, idea of perceptions and misconceptions of certain races and assumptions that one person from one race would make about the other based on the colour of their skin and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
you look back at something that involved blackface and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. In its more intellectual times, which are, I guess, far and few between, it is trying to make a larger point about perception and racism. But fundamentally, it is just a straight-up comedy that's having fun at the expense of, I guess, rich white people who live secluded and boring lives on a little remote bit of America.
I don't know, it kind of tries to strike a balance, because it starts out with the townsfolk. It starts out with... I can't remember Jackson's character's name.
Well, it'll be two names.
Andrew Sterling, yeah, who's like successful black writer, producer, filmmaker. He's won the Pulitzer Prize, and he moves to the island and into a house, and some of the white people like see him. I think he's just like messing about with his stereo, and they assume this black guy has just broken into this house yeah. and is stealing stuff. So they call the police. The police turn up. There's a big misunderstanding because the police think black guy on our island, he must be a thief, and shoot at him. And then it kind of turns into a siege, and then the chief of police realizes who he is, and then realizes this is going to look really bad. So they take Nick Cage's character out of prison. And he's like a career criminal, and they stick him in the house and say, okay, if you pretend that you're holding this guy hostage, once this all blows over, we'll ship you off to Canada, you'll be free, mm-hmm. and it'll all be fine. But then the press turn up because of the couple who spotted him in the first place, because they're determined, because they get high, and then they're determined that they're going to get this on national press. So the press turn up at the same time that Amos and Andrew kind of begin to realise that they're being played, and it all just spirals out of control from there.
Yeah. So, thanks for listening to Spoiler-filled Film Conversation.
Sorry.
No, you're right. I think you had all the intentions of just summing up the general gist of it, and the sooner you explain it, the more tangents there are to the escalation of events, really.
Yeah.
That's very correct. That's true. We do come in at the beginning with Samuel Jackson explained, as you just did, and it does take a little while for Nick Cage to be properly thrown in. We've shown him as being some dopey, you know, vague criminal who's done some wrong and got caught. But yeah, it does start off on this... What was the island? Does anyone know where it was?
New England. I don't know if it's named.
Okay.
I don't think they did name it.
It must be near to Canada. Or, well, not necessarily. Nick Cage's geography is apparently terrible in it. Or rather, Amos.
Just the Coen brothers thing that just reminded me. Andrew's Pulitzer Prize winning play was called Your Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, very nice. That's a very subtle pun, really, because almost exactly the same. Yeah. I can kind of imagine that film. I kind of want to watch Your Brother, Where Art Thou. I can see how Your Brother, Where Art Thou changes to be kind of blaxploitation and oddly 90s or something. Much like Posse, which we have done. That's a plug for Posse, and I'm not going to move off it because we haven't talked about this film enough yet. So, Abby, what do you make of the setup at the start? Because essentially, at first, the two white people who are coming up to the house where Samuel Jackson has freshly moved in are talking about, oh, who's that there? I mean, oh, then they think it's the people who used to live there. And it's kind of like, oh, it's a acceptable misunderstanding at first. What did you make of it? I mean, you can elaborate on it if you like as well.
The first mistake is vaguely reasonable.
Yeah, not realising your neighbours have moved out.
But then they just demonstrate how stupid they are.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah. And it kind of starts with, oh, who's that guy? We don't know him. Maybe he's robbing the place. It's a black guy. We've decided it is that. And also, we've given a backstory to the car that went past because it was going fast. It must have been the children. And then it's like, oh, the children, where are they? The black guy must have them hostage. And it's just like, hang on, guys. What's going on? calm your socks.
Yeah, it all comes from he's black, therefore lots of terrible things.
So it's a little bit, for me, that's a little bit like, that's the farce element, I guess. Rather than just being a circumstantial comedy of errors, it's a really, like, crowbarred, like, ridiculous error, you know, that keeps being built upon by more and more ludicrous townsfolk, including the chief of police.
And Brad Dourif, who we've so far failed to mention, because I forgot he was in it and he was great.
What's he known for?
I knew him from Star Trek a bunch of times, and he's also in Deadwood as well.
Oh, is he... who's he in Star Trek? I've seen Deadwood, and I think I know who he is from that, but, like, who's he in Star Trek? Is he... What call it? I don't know Star Trek stuff. Sorry.
Most people would know him probably as Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings.
That's well.
Who's that?
Yeah.
Who's Wormtongue?
The one who manipulates the King of Rohan. He's got, like, no eyebrows and lank, black, greasy hair, and he's very, like, his face is dribbling all the time, and he's Saruman's, like, right-hand henchman.
Okay.
And he's also, he's the voice of Chucky in the Child's Play movies. He's Billy Bibbit in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
That was his, like, first role.
Yeah, and that's quite a famous one, I guess.
He's just been in loads. He was in Exorcist 3. He was the Gemini killer.
Okay, so, like, I didn't go, oh, that guy from anything previously. But he, in this, is essentially the main underling dorpy cop who decides he's going to put, rather, kind of, I guess, another reference to Andy, Amos and Andy, with he puts on, like, black camouflage stuff on his face for, like, no discernible reason other than it's nighttime.
He says night ops.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he's having his little, like, SWAT team army guy moment and going, right, we're going to get this guy, and he gets a bit carried away. And I guess he's pivotal to escalating beyond some people have reported incorrectly that a man has broken into a house. And then he's, like, running up with his gun. He sets off a car alarm that belongs to Andrew. And I guess the car alarm is going off so that there can be even more miscommunication because no one can be heard. And car keys are mistaken for holding guns. And all of a sudden, there's a massive, insane shootout when all the cops go, oh, he's got a gun, let's really just murder him now on the doorstep.
Let's fill him full of holes.
So were you guys on board when this was happening, or were you thinking, oh, what is this at this point?
But it was definitely a tipping point where you were either willing to go with the movie or decide to stop watching. And I kept going, like, okay, this is mental.
Yeah.
I've assimilated that information now, and we'll go on.
Well, I thought it was funny, so that kept me happy.
Yeah,
watching
I mean,
it.
if you're willing to accept how stupid the film is telling you, the island dwellers are, then you can just go with it, and it's fine.
Yeah,
but that is it is quite an ask sometimes.
I guess so. You just have to be willing to go. It's a comedy. Let's have fun. Like lots of, say, Will Ferrell movies are unbelievable and silly. And I think it's just this one starts off. You think, oh, it's going to be fairly normal, and it's just going to be just funny. You know,
The police and some of the townsfolk are just uniformly unpleasant. They are just bad guys, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's like, it would be like watching Dumb and Dumber and turning it off because, oh, these guys are too stupid. It's not realistic.
Yeah. Like, you're kind of missing the point. It is meant to be ridiculous. Yeah. And it's not absolutely insane. It's just, it stops being plausible, and then it's just about having a laugh with this idea of mistaken identity. And then the ensuing cover-up, which is kind of a bit more elaborate and mad on the behalf of the police chief, who is also running for mayor, which I think is crucial to, like, the story, is he wants to run for mayor, so he doesn't want this to be like a media scandal where basically he gets outed as accidental racist or, like, negatively profiling a black guy because, you know, that would look bad, and rightfully so. But to try and cover it up the way he does is particularly devious and insane, as far as I'm concerned.
One of the things I love about the actor is called Dabney Coleman, and he is the best heel actor I've ever known. Every time I've seen him, he's just been this most horrible character that you really love to dislike.
It might be a weird reference, but he reminded me a bit of, like, the principal from Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Has anyone seen that?
I remember it, but
I don't know. Maybe it's just
not drawing the connection.
Maybe he's just because he's a villain and he has a moustache, and I don't know.
Probably.
Maybe not.
He is the principal in Recess.
Is he? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So there may have been subconscious reasons I saw a principal in him. For whatever reason, he is a rather good, as you say, Abby, heel or bad guy or whatever. And I do find him, like, in the same sort of way that, I guess, maybe the robbers from Home Alone, like, you kind of do enjoy them on screen. He's not quite Joe Pesci standard of, and the other guy, what's the other guy called?
Daniel Stern.
They're both brilliant, and that is a great film, but it's that kind of, you're enjoying the fact that there's a villain and stuff, you know?
Yeah, and, like, because he plays it so well, like you were saying, Abby, like, he does a really good job of just being really satisfyingly unlikable. You're willing to just let go of how stupid he is because that's just the character, and then the more the situation spirals out of his control, the more you sit there going, yeah, good, it's your own fault.
Yeah. So yeah, basically Andrew is scared and in his house, and he doesn't know what's going on other than there's some kind of person heavily armed outside, and the police, in their attempt to contact what they perceive are the hostages, speak to him. There's a little bit of misunderstanding, but then the police chief understands what's happened, kind of has a head-slapping moment of, oh, what have I done? And then decides, I'm going to make it okay by saying we're going to help you, but actually I'm going to find a criminal and send him in to take you hostage, because this is the obvious solution to this problem, not just explaining and apologising. Isn't that right?
Well, he's also been filmed up to this point by the independent film crew, and he's, like, made out to them that, you know, what he thinks is happening is happening, that some guy has broken in and taken his family hostage. So now it's, like, it's on tape what he is claiming has happened, so he has to make it happen now so as not to look like an idiot.
That's right, there's been a kind of escalation in the story. There's been a Chinese whispers effect where the neighbours who reported the crime have spoken to the press who've turned up, and it's, things are getting added to and conclusions are being jumped to, and it's all getting a bit out of hand. So there is a problem for the police chief that is difficult to get out of. But, you know, his plan is to send in Amos from the prison, who's conveniently a lowlife that will maybe do as the police chief wants, because he makes a bargain that he'll set him free and ignore the crimes he's committed if he'll do this weird favour for him, like, and take Samuel Jackson hostage, and then let him go instantly, because they has to go in and take him hostage. I don't understand why can't you just arrest him outside and then knock the door and say, oh, look, we caught the guy who was firing guns. Sure he is. Why would you send him in? Just protect, you know.
No, because he had to start in a different place to the police.
What do you mean?
But the police couldn't bring him in front of the press, put him, stand in there and go, you're under arrest.
But the only press there at that point was that one guy with the one camera.
Yeah, but it just means that they needed...
We had to sneak him in.
They were trying to make... It was just is an idiot move, and they're trying to make it look as real as they can.
Mm. So it was. You think it was to convince everyone that it's legit. They make him take the hostage and stuff.
Including Andrew.
Plus, yeah, exactly. Plus it's funnier that way, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, Nick Cage is dusted off. This is something I want to talk about. What do you make of the look of Nick Cage in this film?
I haven't had a chance to say it yet, but I would refer to Nicolas Cage in this movie as Nicolas Cage and his amazing acting tooth.
It's amazing.
His amazing acting tooth.
I guess a gold tooth will do a lot of work for you to make you look lazy. He also has incredible hair.
He does. He knew exactly how to position every single bit of his hair, his lips across the teeth, the orientation of his head should just constantly be grubby.
Yeah.
And it juts out to the sides in an incredible way that doesn't seem normal. I don't know.
I've always been glad that Nicolas Cage has always been in denial of his baldness.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how far back he recedes, he will not accept it.
Well, you know, you need occasionally, you know, people need to wear wigs to just so they look different, I guess. So I think in this case, it isn't necessary. It can't be vanity because he doesn't look great this way, you know. It's not the wig of choice for someone who wants to look cool in a movie. It's just a wig of a, like, backwards idiot, like, robber, I guess. But he's not that, I mean, he's not that stupid. He's just, you know, not that well-educated and is happy just robbing people and being a little bit too interested in a creepy way in young girls. Not young, older young girls. But still
they do a decent...
Weird.
Well, yeah, like 16, 17.
It's grubby and horrible, but it could be... I mean, you know, we're meant to like him a bit.
Yeah, I think they do a fairly decent job. I think a lot of it is Nicolas Cage's performance, where he doesn't go all out. He just seems like a guy who's had a kind of rough life.
Yeah, that sea monkey story.
Yeah,
says it all. Where he wants sea monkeys for ages and ages and ages, and his dad wouldn't get any, and then finally his dad leaves and he never comes back, and he hassles his mum, and his mum gets him sea monkeys. It just turns the water brown, and eventually
they're just rubbish, and it's just it's just like a perfect encapsulation of his life.
He wants the happy family on the box, and instead it just turns to scummy water. It is a beautiful and funny and like little story he tells. I like as well, when he tells it, he's a bit oblivious to how tragic it is, because he just gives the ending it just doesn't bother him that it's kind of a sad, bleak story that totally sums up his life, I guess. What about Samuel Jackson then? We didn't talk much about how Andrew Sterling looks. He basically, Samuel Jackson's got a little bit of a beard, glasses, and a bit of hair, but he's also got a helicopter landing patch as well. It's kind of going for average middle-aged man look, haven't they?
He very much looks like a professor.
Yeah.
He's meant to look like an intelligent black man, and that involves glasses and bad jumpers.
I thought he was really good in this because I'm so used to him being shouty Samuel L. Jackson.
Mm.
It's always nice to see him doing something quite... I would hesitate to call this film particularly subtle, but like...
His part of it.
Yeah, his performance is quite subtle, and he's obviously like... There's a lot in this film that they're obviously attempting to do, and they don't quite succeed as far as like the message goes.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing about judging people on their race and all that kind of stuff. But you can kind of get the sense that Samuel Jackson actually saw that when he read the script and really kind of did try to invest something in his character.
Mm. Yeah, and essentially what's unusual for his character in this is he's a bit more of a coward. He's a hostage for the start of it. And though he kind of gets a bit more laid back about how the situation is going, even though it's getting more out of hand, he's not cool and he's not Like, he defends himself with a frying pan. He's not, you know, the guy who's going to kick in doors and execute suckers. I mean, this is a Samuel Jackson trying to play, you know, basically a middle class, like, you know, intellectual guy, I guess, who isn't cool and hasn't been raised in the hood, per se, you know? And that's kind of his backstory, is that his... He talks about his father and how his father would kind of stop him using slang and, like, wash his mouth out with soap to teach him a lesson about but not being, like, a stereotypical from-the-hood black person.
They did still live in... Didn't they live in...
Harlem or somewhere.
Harlem. So they grew up in a rough neighbourhood, but his dad was an intellectual and he wanted them to not be associated with that kind of culture. So, yeah, you have the story about him washing his mouth out with soap because he was using slang and stuff.
Yeah,
but that's why he's got that chip on his shoulder about not forgetting that he's black.
Yeah, but he also has interesting issues because obviously it's been successful. He is a very well-paid and successful guy, and you know it's a weird thing where he's got his own prejudices about he's being perceived as like oh I'm black therefore I must be a robber. And it's like his prejudice is right initially because. All the white people did think he was like a crook, and it's a weird dynamic because in a way, Amos is there to show him that look, not everyone's just prejudiced. Like some people think you're just some guy, you know. It's kind of an interesting little.
There's a weird, like, contradiction maybe in this film that I can't work out if it was deliberate or not, or whether it works or it doesn't work. Mm. In that, you have. Amos and Andrew themselves, who do have, like, their relationship is really well done. And the performances are both good because they're, like, broad enough, but still subtle enough that you, like, you're on both their sides. And you understand where both of them come from because they're both given, like, fairly decent backstories and they perform their monologues about those backstories very well. So... Their relationship with their own race, each other's race, and each other is quite good. Mm. And then you have this weird, like, really panto kind of relationship between the police and the townsfolk and the people who come up from New York to defend Andrew and to get him out of the house. And it's like there's these weird kind of, like, stereotypical representations of, like, some kind of black power movement and like racist rednecks and they call each other so like the leader of the black eyes Reverend something I can't remember his name like calls Runch. The police chief Reverend what
Runch
okay well he they have that like shouting match back and forth and like he calls the chief of police a fascist the chief of police calls him a New York liberal and then they like clash and burn the house down and it's like I couldn't work out whether the film was doing that on purpose, like giving us a really over-the-top representation of two stereotypes and then at the same time giving us a more kind of nuanced version, or whether they'd kind of come up with these two ideas separately and were like, well, you just shove them both in and see what happens.
I think the only reason that they have the bus of black people coming down is because they needed to set fire to the house.
Black people will do it. What are you saying? I think they wanted to bring up the conflict between all the white people on the island. They needed some black people to, you know, to clash heads, I guess, didn't they?
Considering the message of the film, it was strangely racist.
Yeah.
I was like, what are you, like, you're contradicting your own point here.
Well, basically, like, when the news breaks that Andrew Sterling has been taken hostage, the community he's from realize and decide that the kind of black preachery types get together and go, let's get on the buses and light torches and go sort out these racist white people. It's very strange.
But then again, like, there's a few things that get said along the way that suggest that while Andrew was suspicious that white people would treat him differently, he also wanted to get away from his other community.
Yeah, he's
because they're so full on.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an element of like hypocrisy that's called out by Amos at times. They just kind of like, oh, why do you not live here? Why have you come away from your community? If you know, and it's kind of, is there a Is there a hypocrisy from Andrew as well is kind of an issue, I guess.
Yeah. It actually kind of reminded me at times quite a lot of John McClane and Zeus in Die Hard with a Vengeance. Because you had that thing of, like, of John McClane turning it around on Zeus and saying that he's racist. He just doesn't like white people.
Yeah, I very much thought of Die Hard 3 when watching this as well. It was a very similar two guys, a white guy and a black guy forced together. Black guy's got some prejudices. The white guy doesn't want to be misconstrued, you know.
Yeah, this is a strange thing to say, but this is more kind of subtle and nuanced about it. You know, Die Hard with a Vengeance, because it's an action movie, it's way more kind of on the nose with that kind of
idea. There's also a bank robbery going on in Die Hard 3, and they have to weigh jugs of water on stuff. But just, there's all kinds of guff getting in the way of maybe a message about that. But back to this film and more of the plot then, because we've talked a bit about some of the issues that come up and all that, but essentially what has happened is, from the hostage situation, Andrew slowly gets to grips with the fact that something's up. Like, it isn't just, oh, Nick Cage or Amos is this crazy guy. It kind of quite quickly, the pennies start to drop, and it becomes obvious that there was a more elaborate scam involving the police chief. But I think the crucial turning point was the police chief becomes the hero, decides, I'll go in and stop Amos, like planned now. And then, for some reason, he's oddly racist while Amos has got the gun as planned to Andrew's head or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I think he was calling his bluff.
What do you mean?
He was calling his bluff. He was saying that I don't care if you shoot him, so that it takes the value away from shooting him.
I guess, because there is a bit of, like, when basically Amos has decided he's not going to quite go to plan, because he realises the press know it's him now, and that he's probably not going to get the deal of going away scot-free. So he's a little bit worried that now that he's agreed to this strange plan, he won't be able to go free, and that he will take the fall, basically. So it does tie in with the police chief trying to... the police chief is also genuinely trying to get back Andrew now from Amos, because it's starting to go a little bit out of plan, but...
This is... one of the problems that the film had for me is that, like, there was too much going on.
Sure.
Like, things were getting a little bit too... Maybe it was trying too hard to be that kind of, like, Coen Brothers-style caper where stuff just keeps getting piled on. But it was getting piled on as if they hadn't thought it through properly, and then stuff just kind of kept happening. And I did feel kind of like I couldn't keep up a couple of times.
Well, it's just things don't quite make sense if you know they're funny and it's good for the plot to move on and build relationships and stuff. But it's like, so the police chief throws in a racist remark that kind of annoys Andrew Sterling, and so he kind of, once Amos gives up the gun to the chief as the chief kind of wanted anyway, then Andrew decides I'm going to hit him with a frying pan and tell him not to be racist because that's not cool, and there's like, and now Amos can take you hostage again.
Oh, and he has. And then they go on the run together.
It's a weird thing, because basically what happens is they sneak out the back door just in time, and then for ages the hostage situation is focused on that house that's now empty, but no one realises, and Amos and Andrew have ran a few blocks away to, what a coincidence, the neighbours who started this all off's house. They break in there.
That's the other problem. Them ending up in the house of the couple who started it in the first place is a pretty big ask for the audience to just be like, sure, why don't they end up there?
But they are the kind of most comedy characters. The two people who make the mistake in the first place are a kind of constant, like, characters that are always being used to create jokes and make, like, they're kind of funny comedy characters in their own right. They're kind of...
Yeah.
I mean, it very much is a comedy, so if you've accepted that it's silly and you're going to enjoy it, you should still be on board with what is quite a coincidental, like, circumstance, I guess.
I was just going to take the opportunity to name drop Bob Balaban.
I was going to do exactly the same thing. because that was like one of the parts where the movie was starting to lose me a little bit, and then they introduced him.
Is this the shrink?
And his little side story where he's just supposed to be providing some kind of over-the-phone therapy to talk Amos down, and just talks about his own traumatic, like mildly, not even traumatic childhood, but things he considers traumatic, like the clown for his birthday, who then was trained to be a dentist.
It's just this really weird gag they came up with. It's almost like they had him available and they were like, yeah, do some of your shtick where you talk to yourself and you ignore the world and we'll just, you'll prattle on and it'll be funny. It's an interesting move. Abby, did you like it, or did you think it was a bit weird? I think it was a little bit like, do we need this? But did you enjoy the joke about the shrink trying to phone in the hostage negotiations or whatever?
I thought it was a little bit weak when it started, but then when you got to the point where he was just lying down in the car talking.
Yeah, just literally, he's...
I was totally with it.
Yeah, he's kind of on the couch, and he's kind of he's basically just using it as an excuse to, you know, I don't know, what, like, he's just on the...
Vent.
Sorry?
He's just using it as an excuse to vent himself.
Yeah, exactly. And it is kind of a nice semi-throwaway gag that I think does work eventually, like you say. But yeah, that's kind of back at the hostage situation, and our main characters have moved and broken into the house of the two people who set up the whole misunderstanding. And it kind of, we spend a little bit of time there then, where there's, it kind of is stalled by Amos and Andrew not knowing that, like, Amos eventually thinks they're surrounded, even though they're not, because he has a police radio and there's miscommunication. But basically they stay there and uncover more of the reason why this has got so out of hand, hasn't it?
It's the moment where he orders a pizza, and that's how he finds out there's no police outside. That was actually one of the moments I had more of a problem with than any of the others.
All right.
It's like, you ordered a pizza, it wasn't in your name, but you thought there were police outside.
I think the pizza. So I think he ordered it before he thought they were surrounded, just when they're exploring the house, you know. Plus, he tried to order a pizza in the jail earlier, and it didn't come. And it's also because the girl who delivers pizzas is young and hot. It's kind of weird. But you think it was just you were starting to lose faith in it at that point, or
the way he reacted when she brought the pizza and there were no cops? I felt like it was neither reinforcing that there were no cops or surprising that there were no cops, and it somehow actually made it more confusing.
Yeah, like you couldn't work out whether he'd known the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think what's weird about the whole scene in the neighbor's house, really, is they start rummaging in the house for... Like, I guess they're looking for keys to take the car, and then they're kind of delayed, and they bond a bit, and they chat. They kind of stall there, and I can't quite remember if there was a good enough reason that they just stay in the house for a bit.
Maybe... Well, that is where the Sea Monkeys monologue happens, though, so it does have that.
Yeah, well, it has merits, but it's just, why are you here? Why can't you escape already? Maybe they should have got away a bit quicker. And I just, for whatever reason, I guess maybe because Amos is kind of enjoying rummaging through someone else's house, they do a few, there's some personal massages that are made a joke of, and they find some, like, S&M gear that belong to the neighbours. Oh, this is my term for...
The way you put that was absolutely divine.
Thank you. I believe that's the technical term for those items. But they have a bit of fun in the house, and we get to see that Amos is probably a robber, because it's more fun to rob people and take cars and things than it is to live life doing a factory job or something. And at that point, I guess Sterling is going along with it because he's not really sure how dangerous Amos is and stuff.
I see, this is the problem I had at this point. Like, I thought at this point, for Sterling, it was clear that Amos wasn't going to do anything to him.
Yeah.
And I couldn't work out exactly why he was still there.
I guess he doesn't trust the police very much.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I put it down to that so far, Amos was the only person who'd really been honest with him in any way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that he didn't know anyone, and everyone else seemed to be quite terrible.
Yeah, everyone else that seems to live on the island is completely insane. So maybe staying with the maniac who's taking you hostage, who's not dangerous, is probably the... I don't know. It was a bit far-fetched, but that's something that will always be called into question throughout the film. But for whatever reason, they develop their relationship. They get to know each other a bit in these neighbors' house. They make friends with a dog called Rommel, and they become a proper, like, little buddy team, you know?
Yeah.
And then the neighbors turn up because they have to check on the dog, and then they become the new hostages, and that it kind of, again, we need to get up another escalation. So we've got new hostages now. The police haven't quite become aware that they're not in the house they think they're in, and we've got the comedy neighbor characters again to have a laugh at and enjoy. Just
tied up in S&M gear.
Yeah. So I like that it uses these characters in almost all of the film. These two like neighbor characters that are there from the start interact with the press, the police. Like they're in every bit of the movie, being like funny middle class white people. You know, I for one enjoyed them. Did you like the two characters of the neighbors?
Sort of. They were a little bit more of a, I would say deus machina, but I'm not sure if I'm actually using it right.
I would just say they were generally sometimes too much of a plot device.
Yeah.
I kind of liked that about it. I mean, I think because it was so farcical, that's kind of, farce is always, like, as opposed to regular comedy, comedy is just trying to be funny and it'll do it however, but farce always has to be more ludicrous and like more silly, and farce is often like a very intricate plot, especially with farcical plays. They're very much, because they're in a play, I guess, they have fewer characters, they always have to, it has to be quite an intricate mesh of silliness. So I think that was just a kind of a more farcical thing, as if it's, oh, it's the neighbours again. What's, you know, you're kind of meant to roll your eyes at the comedy at times, you know?
Yeah,
okay.
So what basically happens is we have a bit of stupidity involving, for some reason, the hostage neighbour won't give the car to them. He won't give the car keys to Amos so they can escape. He'll give them everything else. He offers them pretty much everything else he owns, but is particularly attached to his ex-wife's present of a car. I don't really get why he loves the car so much, other than that must have been a funny joke as far as the writer was concerned or whatever.
No, it was. I thought that was weird too.
It just seemed like, okay, is the car... I mean, what's the thing with the car?
They justified it a little bit in that it cost $50,000.
Yeah.
And how he wouldn't really be able to replace it, I don't think.
And they're all kind of cottoning on to the fact that Amos isn't going to kill anyone. So it's like, oh, all right, we'll just... You can just abuse us however you want until...
Yeah.
You know, you do whatever. But basically, they do end up... They end up leaving, and as they get into the car, and Amos seems to be of the opinion, as he kind of should be, that Andrew's now his friend, and Andrew's like, I'm not your friend, then why are you still here? But we're buddies, we're gangsters, you know, they kind of, he's caught up in the excitement of it all, and then suddenly Sterling realises, I don't actually need to be here, and he starts to walk away, and... That's kind of where their relationship starts to break apart, I guess. Andrew decides, right, I'm getting out of here. Amos does take the car, and possibly the dog. I can't remember if the dog ends up coming with them.
It tries to, but I don't think they let it in the end.
Yeah, because there is a point where you're like, yeah, Andrew and Amos, you go off into the sunset with Rommel the dog. And, you know, there's kind of a nice joke, ongoing joke about, like, Andrew's relationship to dogs and stuff as well, which is kind of interesting. They do a little bit of a joke about like how the dog reacts to them and stuff, and like the dog doing tricks and stuff. And I kind of like the comedy involving the dog, actually, which is unusual. Usually animal comedy in films is kind of tedious and cringy. But I kind of enjoyed Rommel as his little part. What did you guys, do you guys like Rommel, the dog?
Yeah, I thought so.
I love dogs, so I'm biased.
Fair enough. You guys might have to correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially, they've got some. The police discover slowly that basically they get in the house and realise, oh no, that's the thing, is your man from Deadwood and all that. He's He decides he's off for a little too long with his plan when he thinks he's in charge. The chief is tied up in the house. I forgot to mention that. Could any of you sort out the plot that I seem to have missed here involving the chief of police and stuff?
They leave him tied up in the house, and then he manages to escape by himself.
Oh, that's right. And he's getting tortured by the shrink.
Yeah.
Phoning in and just telling him loads of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, what is the name of the guy who's like the like insane army guy who thinks he's in a movie, or he is in a movie, but he's like taking on this hostage situation, like I'm in charge now, and he's like gone off to get into special gear and stuff. Who was his name?
That was Brad Dourif.
Yeah, and so his character eventually breaks into the house and gets misconstrued as being Amos because the police all kind of go in and arrest him instead, and the police chief goes along with it. Yeah, yeah, you're Amos. Shut up. Let's make this look good for the press and things. and then they realise that they have to find, Andrew, who's missing. The search involves bloodhounds or something, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then that's when the police, they unleash the dogs, and Andrew ends up running through a field being chased by the dogs, and Amos is driving the car and happens to rescue him. And then they sort of just charm the dogs into stopping, I guess.
Yeah, they use the police chief's badge, which I can't remember how Andrew got hold of.
They did that classic thing of, he must have pickpocketed him at some point.
Although
he was knocked out, though, wasn't he? So.
Yeah, I think they just took his stuff when he was knocked out and they were tying him up.
Okay.
They didn't make it clear enough, I guess. But no. It felt a bit like, oh, that's convenient at the end where...
Yeah, and because they get him to get the police chief sent off the badge and then send them the dogs chasing after the chief.
Yeah, and the chief by now has stepped in glass and banged his head. Oh, he had his head, he was hit by a frying pan. So he's at the sort of, like, Home Alone... Getting close to Home Alone levels of pain and torture. But not quite that bad. But he's bandaged up and then he's being attacked by dogs. And the movie kind of comes to an abrupt kind of, we must finish now because the movie mustn't go over 90 minutes. And we don't really see a tie-up other than Andrew does go in the car with Amos and they drive to safety somewhere, presumably.
The reporters from the beginning get hold of the tape that reveals that the whole thing was a mistake and a setup by the chief of police.
Yeah, that's something then, I kind of missed out explaining, yeah.
You have this weird double conclusion then where, the chief of police sees the tape and is like, oh, no, where did you get that? And then the dogs turn up and he runs away. And it's, it's never quite revealed whether people find out about the whole thing. And then you get this oddly rushed little conclusion.
Yeah, we don't know how the press reacts to the chief of police. We don't know what happens. We just know that the truth is presumed to have come out because... I forgot to mention the tape that seems to be... The original press that are there filming it have a tape that gets a lot of the initial reports from people and the chief and stuff. And that kind of outs the story and it would explain the misunderstanding. And that was passed on from one person to another, and eventually via the pizza girl who turned up, gets passed back to the press that started filming at the start. And we're to assume that it all concluded in a way that the baddies were treated fairly, and the good, and I guess our heroes walk off into the various sunsets, isn't it? So, and then basically, a bit weirdly, Andrew is then dropped off next to his wife, who is arriving in a car.
Yeah,
and it's just like, how did you find his wife in a queue of cars?
No, that makes sense though, because there's only one ferry on and off the island where the house is.
Oh, okay.
And she was on her way back from Buffalo, Boston.
But why is she coming to why do they want to stay on the island?
And then isn't it?
And then he's like, oh, the house needs more work than we thought. Yeah, because it's been burned down. It's like, that's not more work than we thought. We need a new house.
It's been peppered with shotguns and burnt down accidentally in one of those ridiculous farcical ways.
Also, by the way, all the townsfolk hate us.
Yeah.
Even though this whole thing was a setup, they're going to hate us anyway now.
Yeah.
And they're all really, really racist.
Yeah. But yeah, let's still live there. Like,
well, no. He's going to sue the police department and use that money to rebuild the house, which he will then sell. They can't just abandon the place. For crying out loud.
Okay, good. But
after that, night, I think I'd accept. I mean, if I was a successful rich guy, I'd be like, yeah. Oh, I can take the loss if I never have to return to this island again.
Yeah, I really wouldn't want to hang around.
But we do. Amos leaves Andrew to explain things or not to his wife, and then drives off once again in the wrong direction. Because he's supposed to be heading to Canada, and he's going the wrong way. Lol. but yeah, we kind of... They've made friends and have become... at least they have a story, and they have a... You know, they've sort of become friends in a sort of, we'll never see each other again. But, you know, you were the one less insane person I met all night.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's more or less the film right there. Would you guys, have I missed any things out there? Have you guys got any other bits you want to bring up?
I don't think so. No, we've covered a great deal there.
So, you know, it's, I think, a rather interesting farce. I think I think it had its heart in the right place. At times it's a bit sloppy and not quite that well knitted together. And some elements are a little bit too stereotypical and silly.
Some elements
as well. That's what I meant. Elements. Yeah. You know, there's problems with it, but fundamentally, I had a laugh watching it, and I thought that Nick Cage and Samuel Jackson were not their usual roles, but they were both really good in it. So that's kind of my reaction to it overall. I'd be interested to hear what you guys overall thought of it. What about you, Jamie?
I liked it. I didn't this wasn't another posse. I felt like it was under-realized.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was necessarily, like... I don't think it had anything to do with budget constraints or anything like that. I think it was, like... It was very competent in a lot of ways. Like, it looked fine. The performances were good, I'd say, from everyone. Dabney Coleman was great as the police chief. Brad Dourif was great as Donnie. Even like little bit players, Michael Lerner and Margaret Collin, the two neighbours who start the whole thing off.
They are very funny,
Yeah, as much as they were a little bit too much of a plot device, they were good in their roles.
Yeah, just some roles are very over the top, and other roles are a little like...
Yeah.
Basically, Andrew and Amos are a little more down to earth, even though they're...
Yeah, and I think they both do a really good job of it as well. I think they're likeable enough that as the film gets like a little bit, you know, you start thinking, really? I don't know. You still want to see them come out
on top.
Well, at the end. Yeah. You want to see them come through it, and you do kind of want to see them bond, but it is a little bit too strange sometimes. Like there's a few too many times throughout the film where things have to kind of twist a little bit too much to fit into where the plot is required to go.
Yeah.
Mm.
Like it's almost like you can see the writers like struggling to think how can we and like there's a few too many little conveniences that keep dropping in.
Yeah, it's like they're forcing certain jigsaw pieces to fit when maybe they don't. But in a way, I kind of like that the outcome of that.
It makes a really admirable attempt of throwing things in and escalating, and sometimes it works and sometimes it just doesn't. Mm. And I think the other problem I have with it is the strange kind of mixed message it gives.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, maybe we shouldn't judge by a book by the cover, but judge all these books by their covers.
These
anyway.
Books are way stereotypical and we should laugh at them.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know, it kind of doesn't go either way with its message. It's like, oh, look at all these crazy racists and all these typical black people, but also at the same time understand that this black guy and this white guy are very nuanced and have pasts. And it's like,
it wants to have cake and eat it. And
yeah, one or the other, you know, have a, you know, and the message with Andrew and Amos themselves is an admirable one.
Yeah.
Like, if they'd run with that completely, but I think the problem then is you'd have too serious a film.
Yeah, that's it. And it does need to be funny and over.
Yeah, and it struggles between having a proper, having something to say and yet being farcical and just silly as well. But it's not, I don't know, it's not bad, but I can understand why it's been kind of forgotten.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm not sure what rating we're going to have to think of our tenuous, spoiler-filled film conversation rating scheme. But any suggestions before I throw it to Abby to give her say? What can we rate it as?
For me, this film is a lot like Dr. Huxtable's Family in the Bill Cosby Show.
Okay.
Where they've gone out of their way to create a family that is counter-stereotypes and really positive. But then, because it's such a designed family, it feels really unreal.
I can actually think of a decent one because of that.
Oh, go on.
And it's an excuse for me to make reference to the PJs again.
Okay, this year.
It makes me think of that show, because that show like got in loads of trouble. The reason it was cancelled was because there was such an outcry because it was perceived as racist. Because it has a similar kind of weirdly mixed message. Like, it has likable characters and is a funny show.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the characters are sometimes a little bit too broad in their stereotypes, and you do kind of think, man, I don't know about that. Like, it makes you uncomfortable for a family, you know, animated sitcom to be that, like, near the knuckle with some pretty, like, you know, unpleasant things that it says sometimes about minority characters. And it's that mix of tones of, like, look at these likable characters who are also potentially stereotypes. And this film kind of does exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I think in many ways the PJ's TV show animation or whatever is also quite obscure and forgotten, but also it's still funny. Like, you know, it's still good.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, if you can let go of the mixed mixed message about race and just look at it on the basis of, like, jokes.
That's probably true of the original Amos and Andy. I mean, I don't know much about it, but it seems like
if you can ignore the blackface,
if you can ignore the racism, it's funny. Like, I don't know. But Abby, any last thoughts on the film? I mean, you've given your rating system already, so.
No, Jamie covered a lot there. Where it came so close to doing something really good.
Yeah.
But it's just. Because it was written and directed by one guy, and so far as I'm aware, he hadn't directed anything before then or since.
No.
So I just think he needed more help.
Maybe get the Coen brothers in. They could have made it a bona fide hit.
It seems like something they could have almost done. Yeah. Like, if they come in and, like, just as writers or something, they could have elevated it, because it has a lot of potential there.
Yeah, definitely. So we'd hand it over to the Coens. And it would be excellent, perhaps. But as it is, it's just okay.
Because, you know, he was in Raising Arizona and he was great in that, so.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's my thing. I think that someone should have been there for the guy's name is E. Max Fry. And
great name.
He couldn't do it on his own, but he tried really hard.
Yeah, I feel bad for him because it was his first go, and fair play to him for pulling off something reasonably decent for a first attempt.
They shot at night, and I thought it was quite well shot. I think there was kind of a nighttime atmosphere to the whole thing, that kind of late at night assumptions get made kind of atmosphere, you know. And when it was morning at the very end, it felt like by the end of the film, you do feel like, oh, another day at last, we're out of that nightmare of a night, you know. So there was some elements that were good.
I didn't think about that, actually.
So I wouldn't say it was a bad directorial job. It was just, like, it could have been a bit tighter.
It is, now that Abby's drawn attention to the fact that it was one director and one writer, and it was his first attempt, it is like, it does seem like he was juggling all these elements and going, like, oh, guys, help, please, somebody help me.
Yeah.
And, like, nobody was listening to him.
Yeah. I haven't thought of a rating system for myself. I guess our rating system is how black people are portrayed in the media.
We're getting a bit deep with this one.
I think it's cool. Like, you know, we're all white, in case that isn't obvious enough.
Yeah.
If I was to try and think, it reminded me a bit of the crows in Dumbo, where there's, like, these stereotypical, like, it's like the crows are basically black people, but they talk in weird, like, well, they talk in black dialect and stuff, and they're funny characters. And you kind of watch it and you go, oh, it's really funny. When you get older, you go, is this racist? Are the crows in Dumbo a bit of a racist stereotype? But they're still funny. Kind of doesn't matter, in a way.
It makes me laugh, and then I feel terrible about myself because it's so racist.
but legit, it's not. I don't think any of it is intended to be mean. Like all of it isn't to be misconstrued as like. At the end of the day, comedy is about stereotyping, and stereotypes are funny. And it, you know, none of the things we've mentioned are that offensive. It's just. It's an awkward sort of area where people get a bit defensive and things.
This is gonna be a really, really bizarre thing to say, but it's almost like it's well-meaning racism.
Yeah.
Like it's horrible assumptions made with the heart in the right place.
Yeah.
But it's so misguided and like, I'm talking like specifically about the crows in Dumbo now. Like,
yeah.
At the time, that no one saw anything wrong with it. It's only looking back where you go, yeah, no.
I think there's a context as well. I think, you know, it isn't necessarily done with malice. It's not an attempt to have a go at a community. It's just, you know, people interpreting people and going, you know, making characters based on people they've met. You know, I don't think it's done a lot of the time with malice. It's just done because it's good to make... Like, comedy has to be made out of everything in life, and to exclude certain communities because the time was more racist would be weird. I don't know. And Amos and Andrew isn't that racist. It's just about race issues, and I don't know.
But this is the problem with the film, is that there is so much about this topic that you can discuss, and the film kind of gives itself an opportunity but never quite does anything with it. It just hints at it, and then...
Yeah.
And then throw stereotypes at you. And it's like, well, what are you trying to say?
Yeah. Anyway, Amos and Andrew, I mean, it was a moderately reasonable farce as far as I was concerned. It isn't altogether terrible. It isn't quite up to the level we'd want it to be. But we've chatted about it now, guys. And so before I or any of you guys end up saying something that gets misconstrued by... the internet, because you know how the internet likes to misconstrue things. Before any topics turn to things that may sound racist but definitely aren't, we'll say goodbye from this week's episode. Bye.
Bye. I'm sorry.